lot of erudition and a lot of achievement that he carries. He's written more than half a dozen books. He has been an editor of Fortune magazine and half a dozen other magazines. He's now writing a regular column in Europe from Switzerland, which gives him a high and elevated, as well as a neutral viewpoint, so not a neutralist one. He is a co-founder of National Review, with which he still retains a family kinship. And he is altogether a man of great accomplishment, and as you will find out in a moment, a man who has things to say that are both striking, fascinating, and finally profound. Mr. Schlapp.
Let me first try to make two clarifications. One about foreign policy and the other one about the press, because this is my subject, foreign policy and the press. Now, I contend that foreign policy is actually the last refuge of the intellectual rascal. Number two, I contend there is no public opinion, there is only published opinion. And having made these two clarifications, I beg you to understand both terms, which I'm going to use throughout my speech, in my sense. And the conclusions I draw first of all from these two clarifications is that the press has no influence on foreign policy, but that the press is foreign policy. All we call foreign policy is nothing but published opinion. Now, I've made the press the subject of my studies of a long, long lifetime on both sides of the ocean. And I've achieved a degree of contempt for the institution, which will indubitably show in all I'm saying, but which I want to qualify. It's a contempt spiritually and unlimited limitation, unlimited admiration for the competence and historic consequences of the performance. I think that the Third World War has started in 1945 and has gone on until recently, and I think it's over. We've lost it. The Third World War that started in 1945 is what you might call a horizontal war, a completely new form of war, no longer a vertical war, no longer horizontal war across borders between nations competing for power and competing for possession. It's a vertical structure of war that goes through all over the world. It is a international, worldwide civil war. Since 1945, we are engaged in a worldwide civil war, and one of the main reasons for the indubitable fact that we are losing this war or have already lost this war is that we refuse to recognize the fact that this is an international civil war. Now, why do I say this? Because it's terribly important if you talk about foreign policy and the influence the press has on foreign policy, it's terribly important to realize that what we traditionally call foreign policy no longer exists. There is no national foreign policy conceivable and effective. There is the foreign policy of the civil war in which we are engaged in 1945 is a new, spectacular, and special kind of policy. What I mean by this is simply that the foreign policy of a conservative American is identical with the foreign policy of a conservative Chinese. And that the foreign policy of a leftist American is identical with the foreign policy of a German leftist. And any attempt at trying to be objectively concerned with national interests and forget about the rest is doomed, has been doomed, and has failed for the last 35 years. Now, I say the press has not just influenced foreign policy, but is foreign policy. Why is it so? Let's face reality. The reality is that about 2% of our population, the population of all Western countries, has any interest in foreign policy, and certainly even less competence for foreign policy. Foreign policy, therefore, has become the monopoly possession of an arrogant, egalitarian, elitarian group of intellectuals who develop a certain facility in the usage of language, of words, of terms, and can freely monopolize the whole field of foreign policy because there is no one to challenge them. In foreign policy, your famous normal citizen admits, concedes complete incompetence, complete lack of information or even comprehension of what it is all about, and concedes the field to this elitarian group of self-appointed, arrogant intellectuals. This fact that foreign policy is the reserved monopoly for a small 1-2% group of the population is of tremendous and fatal importance. Because in all other respects, you can expect and rely upon the fact that the normal citizen will catch up with the foolishness, the fallacy, and the rascality of the so-called liberal position, because it's within his own experience. In the whole domestic sphere, the liberals are indeed exposed to comprehension, exposed to a comparable competence of comprehension, and are therefore, as I heard this morning with great interest, about to lose in America. I'm not quite sure they have been convinced this morning, but let's assume they are supposed to lose in this country in the field of domestic policy. They are most certainly not endangered in the field of foreign policy. Because in the field of foreign policy, the American people, like any other people in the Western world, it declares its incompetence, its complete incapacity of comprehending what it's all about, and leaves gladly and without any control and any challenge the whole subject to the small, elitarian, arrogant, self-appointed group of experts. Well, these experts are nothing but journalists. Because the great strength of the other side in this civil war is that this other side has completely understood these two facts. It is, number one, understood that this is indeed an international civil war that's been carried on now for 30 years. And secondly, they've understood that in this civil war, nothing matters but control over foreign policy. Now, that they have so clearly understood this situation is the real reason for their apparent invincible progress in the whole world. And I propose to discuss this structural situation studying the three outstanding examples of press and press influence on foreign policy, press relations between nations, three great and important examples of so-called world opinion. Number one is Le Monde in Paris. Number two is the Neue Zürcher Zeitung. And number three is the German press. Now, I pick these three things because I know them well and I know them from the inside. And because, tragically, American foreign policy in particular, and particularly since the great conservative Nixon came into power, is nothing but a shy and modest and humble look at world public opinion. Now, world public opinion is really and truly and correctly represented by these three sample cases I've chosen. Le Monde in Paris. Indubitably the most brilliant newspaper in the world. Competent, extremely well informed, stern and rigid in the intellectual demands it puts on its readers, a brilliant newspaper. It is completely under the control of a small group of about 20 highly competent, well-educated, and hopelessly leftist intellectuals. Now, I used to know the founder and editor-in-chief, Boeuf Marie, very well. And I remember I first met him back in 1946 when I was representing Fortune magazine in Paris. I remember him with awe and amazement. He was an extremely well-educated European, a European of great academic standing. He was a university teacher originally. He founded his newspaper with very, very limited means after the defeat of the Germans in France. A man of great experience, of great knowledge, and I passed the first hour of our conversation with pleasure and admiration. And then all of a sudden the subject of America came up. Just the name was mentioned, America. And this well-educated, brilliant professor turned absolutely barbarian and stupid. The very same face that 1 minute ago was just trembling and brilliant with spirit, with knowledge, with information, turned absolutely red and wild and furious. And all he could utter was the word Coca-Cola. And this was meant as the program of his definitive and final rejection of America. Well, I tried to calm him down and told him, well, what's about Coca-Cola? I don't like it, but what's about it? He said, well, a nation that is obviously on its way to persuade France to drink Coca-Cola is my enemy.
I agree with you 100%.
Now, the way I tell it to you, I hope, is funny and witty, but it wasn't funny or witty when it happened. Because here I saw the living example of profound European erudition, of impeccable taste in intellectual and political matters that collapses the moment it is confronted with the United States. The deep down anti-Americanism of this French elite, particularly Le Monde, the most brilliant newspaper of the world, has to be experienced to be believed. And only I, who was not born an American, would have the ear for the seriousness and depth of the anti-American attitude that is behind it. Now, I was listening this morning to Mr. Shakespeare, and I certainly have great regard for the labors and work of his agency, about which I shall say a few things later on. And Not nevertheless, I beg your pardon, Mr. Shakespeare, but I think that the agency works on an entirely mistaken fundamental proposition. Namely, and to that extent I agree with the remarks of my old friend Evans this morning, it works on the proposition that it has to sell America. And it is wrong. It doesn't have to sell America because America cannot be sold. One of the great differences between the job Mr. Shakespeare is in and the job advertising men of other great corporations are in is exactly this. They are representing saleable goods. And Mr. Shakespeare and his friends and associates are trying to sell something that cannot be sold. America cannot be sold. And let me admit, let me add, it should not be sold. It ought not to be sold. Because the problem is no longer national policy of America at all. Unless America succeeds in proving to the world that it is fighting knowingly, fighting an international civil war, no longer a national policy, representing a national policy, but it is part and parcel of a great international civil war in which it participates, not objectively with the spreading of news and information, but which participates as one whose life depends on winning this war, whose life will be over by losing this civil war. Now, this fellow, Beuve-Marie, this educated, cultured, elitarian Frenchman, could understand America, even the America of Coca-Cola, if America were presented to him as the main battalion in the great international civil war that is being fought all over the world, in which it participates, knowingly taking part, taking side. But you cannot sell America to Le Monde, to Mr. Beuve-Marie, to his friends and his readers, as a national culture with a national foreign policy. Now, the next example, the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, is an extremely interesting example because the Neue Zürcher Zeitung is indubitably the finest conservative publication in the world. It's a conservative newspaper, the one and only conservative daily, not only in Europe, but in the whole world. It's a paper of excellent record, a paper of profound and carefully investigated information, and a paper that is read by all Europeans as the one and only conservative Bible there is in Europe. Now, the same Neue Zürcher Zeitung, which I read every day, rather twice a day, because there's two editions a day, which I read now for I don't know how many years, twice every day, this Neue Zürcher Zeitung has as its correspondent in Washington, Mr. Werner Imhoff, who has now become the dean of all foreign correspondents in Washington. And this conservative newspaper employs Mr. Werner Imhoff for more than 20 years now as correspondent in the chief landscape of the West in America, a man who is, to put it very mildly, to the left of Arthur M. Schlesinger. Werner Imhoff is a man whose writings I read and analyze now for more than 20 years, who in every single case will not only join the left in presenting America in the Neue Zürcher Zeitung to Europe, in the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, but he will be very likely the instigator of every bit of leftist mischief and rascality in Washington. He's not only the direct descendant of the New Deal, but he's the only man who, in the chamber's his case, has for 1 year fought and won a war of misinformation, the like of which I have never seen before, in the Neue Zürcher Zeitung. He's the man who not only was, of course, a Kennedy supporter and Kennedy admirer and adulator, but who was during the whole period of the Vietnam War, the original source of all misinformation about Vietnam, about the war, about America, in the United States. Now, the phenomenon is, he is the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, the wonderful, only, superior, conservative newspaper in Europe, in the world, I should say. And you can't explain to Mr. Luxinger, who is now the editor-in-chief, or his predecessor, that Mr. Imhoff is a misfit. Because for the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, Mr. Imhoff is not a misfit. For the conservative newspaper in Europe, it's almost a necessity to have an ultra-leftist correspondent in Washington, because this is their alibi in Europe. The Neue Zürcher Zeitung, that of course doesn't pay too much attention, does pay some attention to the terrible fact that it's conservative. And therefore, they want to play down the horrible effect of appearing conservative by showing, no, as far as America is concerned, nobody could be more to the left than I am. That's an alibi. Europeans need an alibi of anti-Americanism even in their most noble, in their most competent, in their highest level conservative performance. Now, going to that in a second, why it is so, but let me first state the facts. Now, the German press. The German press, ladies and gentlemen, is clearly the only and true ruler of Germany. If you think, as you ought to, that the New York Times rules the United States, they haven't seen anything yet, because you should see how the Spiegel in Germany rules Germany. It is the only government that matters. Only it's perfectly understandable why this is so in Germany, while it is not understandable why it is so in America, or anyhow, more difficult to understand. It's clearly so in Germany, because Germany is a defeated, humiliated, beaten down nation that has lost all self-confidence, that has lost all self-respect, that has lost all self-reliance, and has lost any traditional authority. And the only authority that is visible or recognizable in Germany is indeed the press. There is no other authority that can at least claim authoritative knowledge, authoritative advice, the capacity for authoritative advice. So the press is indeed the only coherent body of authoritative guidance the Germans could possibly sense or accept. Now, in this strange situation, we have in Germany a press that's been born and has grown up as the so-called Lizenzpresse. It is the offspring of the licensed German newspapers that the Eisenhower military administration of 1946 till 1948 permitted and gave out to certain chosen Germans. The Germans were not supposed, not allowed to publish newspapers, but they were licensed in certain exceptional cases where the military government, the American military government in Germany, felt these people are safe re-educators of the German nation. Well, the trouble with this idea, which is in itself presentable, was that not Mr. Eisenhower ruled over Germany, but a bunch of sergeants in the American army, usually young refugees who returned to Germany and who had their partisan case to fight out with the Germans exposed. And these young sergeants that actually run the military government in Germany. Now, Mr. Eisenhower didn't know much about Germany. Just a to look at Berlin and the fact that Mr. Eisenhower accepted Berlin as it was, as a possible, militarily possible solution, a piece of land to which there was no access. I mean, in first class in military school, you must have learned that such a thing is inconceivable. Well, he accepted it because he didn't know a darn thing about Germany, never wanted to know anything about it. He relied on the young sergeants that run the military government and run it in that sense very consistently. Namely, the license for publishing German newspapers was given only to absolutely reliable communists and fellow travelers. There was not a single German newspaper published in that day whose publisher was not a clearly, recognizably established fellow traveler or communist, or anyhow, at least indubitable leftist. All the German licenses were given to this crowd, and the German newspapers are the offspring of this absolutely absurd situation that the military government run by the United States builds in his own territory a press that is indubitably in the service of the opponent. Now, this I exaggerate, of course. I sort of crudely exaggerate simply because it makes the situation utterly visible. Now, this licenzierte Presse, the Lizenzpresse, is and remains and will remain the bulk, the important part of German public opinion. The tragedy is only that we are going through a very short period of history in Europe in which things are going to be decided and are being decided for all time to come. I think of the current German government, of the Willy Brandt Regierung, of its Eastern policy, which, as you will know, is carried out by a government that has a very, very tiny, small majority in parliament, in the German Bundestag, of about 3 votes, and a government that can carry on its policy, and its foreign policy in particular, only if and as long as it can claim that this policy is okayed by the United States government. And now I'm coming to the real intent behind my speech, namely my herewith submitted thesis that the last chapter of Western civilization will carry the name Henry Kissinger. And I beg Mr. Shakespeare to listen to me for a while. Carefully. I say that Henry Kissinger, not Mr. Nixon, who doesn't know a darn thing about Europe, but Henry Kissinger, who is his advisor, is single-handed responsible for history's most remarkable fact of the century, namely that America, who 25 years ago has conquered Europe, has lost Europe through a government of 3-vote majority, because the American government didn't have the guts and the gall and the comprehension and the courage to say no to the policy of the German government. Now, most of us know Henry Kissinger. I do. He's an impeccable person. He's a man of truly conservative leanings. He's a man who not only by his education and information on learning, but by his own personal exposure to history, is entirely on our side of this battle. He's learned, he's shrewd, he's well-informed, and the highest compliment I can pay him is to say that he knows about Germany even more than I do. And yet, Henry Kissinger is the man who made the policy of the Willy Brandt government not only possible, but made it effective and made it very likely invincible during the next 2 years in which the great decisions will be taken. Because the German government can time and again return from trips to Washington or from diplomatic exchanges and submit to the German people, my policy has been okayed, encouraged, and underwritten by the United States government. Now, I wanted to know that as much as the Germans, like all other Europeans, are anti-American, the Germans, like very few European nations, have still a great respect for the United States, and have still the knowledge and the insight to understand we, the Germans, cannot carry on a foreign policy which is not okay, and not underwritten, and not approved by the U.S. government. If the U.S. government had given so much as one indication of disproving the East policy of the Brandt government, this policy would have broken down a year ago. Each time a German ambassador or a German minister returns from Washington, he has to tell you, I had long conferences with Mr. Kissinger and we are in complete agreement. I haven't seen Kissinger for a long time. I've seen him a few years ago, last time in Germany. And I know that not only is his heart and his mind there where my heart and my mind is, but I know that all his friends and contacts in Germany are on the conservative right. And yet this man sits in the White House, and the moment he got in the position of power, in the position of influence, he collapsed. This is not a matter of insight, but a matter of character. This is not a matter of knowledge, but a matter of stamina. And your noble, elegant, as I can read in the paper, even swinging, conservative type in Washington, Mr. Kissinger, hasn't got that courage and that character that is required. He's afraid of the possibility that he might be made responsible for advice that would carry and would matter, and he doesn't give it. But he, the man who knows more about Germany than I do, and knows it to the smallest detail, advises Mr. Nixon, who, as I heard this morning, said to someone, after all, I'm only the President of the United States. Now, this fellow who is only President of the United States depends entirely on what Mr. Kissinger tells him. What else can he do? That's what he appointed him for, to advise him on foreign matters, on foreign policy, on matters in which this man is indeed an expert. And this man advises him the way he does. So you will understand when I listened this morning to the various speeches I heard, all of them extremely interesting, very attractive, I felt as if I were among Alice's in Wonderland. You were talking about the Rubicon Mr. Nixon is about to cross. Why, for God's sake, he's crossed it a long time ago, and the Rubicon is not in China, but the Rubicon is in Germany. You look the different direction, the wrong direction at the wrong moment. You look to China and to a forthcoming crossing of the Rubicon, while the real area of the decision is in Europe, in Germany, where the Rubicon has been crossed. Now, what do I mean by this? Well, obviously, this German government, for the first time since 1945, is a government of determined men, who are determined to do what they want to do, who are genuine revolutionaries. Well, not Mr. Brandt, who is just a mannequin, a puppet, but Mr. Wehner, who is behind him, who is the actual ruler of German government policies. Mr. Wehner has a perfectly clear-cut conception, and that is the so-called confederation with the East. He's broken with communism in 1940. Mr. Wehner, until that time he was the Secretary General of the Communist Party of Germany, and he became leader of the Social Democratic Party and the actual ruler of Germany under the present government, with this one central idea, and that is we must achieve a socialist Germany by unifying the Western Bundesrepublik with the Eastern communist regime on the 50-50 basis of confederation. This is the old Wiener so-called Deutschland plan, the Germany plan of 1959, which he never had withdrawn, never has revoked. It's still guilty. And this is the intent and content of his policies. A reunification of Bundesrepublik and the Eastern communist territory in a German confederation, i.e. in a socialist communist popular front coalition. Now, the strategic main goal of the Soviets since 1945 has remained the same. It has always been to force the United States out of Europe. The safest, cheapest, and most successful way is the one they are now going, a voluntary capitulation of the Bundesrepublik before the Soviet Union. That the United States government underwrites a policy that no matter what Mr. Rogers or Mr. Nixon or even Mr. Kissinger may think, and no matter what Mr. Brandt may think, must result in a withdrawal of American troops from Europe is inconceivable, and yet it is the reality. The United States government and the foreign policy it is presenting to the world and the information that you, Mr. Shakespeare, are presenting to the world approves of the policy of German government that indeed is the final, last, definitive chapter of European policy, of a European policy that has until now been co-affected by American influence. And the inconceivable, absolutely inconceivable happens. Now, permit me for a second to be absolutely personal to talk about myself, not only because I'm a terribly vain person, but also because it is relevant. I go through this experience. For 12 years now, I'm fighting a one-man crusade in Germany. I write a column, which is the most widely read and the most controversial column in Germany. I'm absolutely alone. The column is being published by Mr. Springer, Axel Springer, the famous monopoly owner of a very, 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 very important chain of newspapers in Germany. I fight a perfectly solitary battle, a one-man crusade for 12 years. I can't complain. I have a huge public, a huge audience. And there's hardly an embassy, foreign embassy in Germany, that is not trying to get in touch with me and to find out what I think about things, with one exception, and that is the U.S. embassy. Well, I happen to be an American citizen, and in certain circles, even well-known American citizen, and yet Mr. Rush, very able and very, very dignified ambassador in Bonn, has never taken the trouble to come and see me or to invite me to come and see him. Now, I'm not too anxious to see him because the cooking in the German embassy in Bonn is famously bad, and I like good food. So that's not the point. The point is that it's conceivable that a man like I lives now for about 12 years in Germany or around Germany. He's the most widely known and most wildly fought about journalist in Germany. He happens to be an American citizen. He's therefore suspected by all leftists in Germany to be a bona fide CIA agent. I. And yet the American ambassador has never seen me. I've never been asked. I've never been inquired. One more fact. There is hardly a German television station or radio station, and all of them are my enemies, and all of them carry on a crusade against me, but there's hardly anyone who's not invited me to speak there. The only one who's never even tried to get in touch with me is Radio Free Europe and RIAS. I'm a non-person as far as America is concerned in Germany. Well, I'm as little a non-person in Germany as as Mr. Kissinger is in America, and even less than Mr. Kissinger is in America. But the American agencies, your agency, Mr. Shakespeare, or the American government, i.e. the American ambassador, Mr. Kenneth Rush in Bonn, do not take notice of my existence. I've never been asked. I've never been interviewed. I've never been asked for advice or for counsel or for information. As I said, every other embassy, as far as I can remember, including the embassy of Abyssinia, was trying to get in touch with me, except the embassy of the United States. Every other radio and television station in Germany was sort of compelled to take notice of my existence. It's hard to overlook my existence in Germany. It's in fact impossible, except for the U.S. Information Service, that has overlooked my existence for the last 12 years in an absolutely fantastic and rather courageous way, which I, in a way, admire, because it's so incredible that it turns to be rather attractive again. Now, the reason of that is obvious. The reason is that I have the fragrance and the reputation of a rightist, of a conservative. And any American agency or any American ambassador abroad would rather die than be in touch with an American conservative or American even rightist, as I'm occasionally very much to my approval called in Europe. They would rather lose America, they would rather lose Europe, they would lose the whole war rather than get in touch with an American conservative, American rightist. The strange fact is that on the board of this agency, next to Mr. Shakespeare, sits my old friend and co-founder of National Review, Bill Buckley. He's a rather colorful and well-known figure in Germany and in Europe. And why the hell don't we get in touch with him? And why the hell don't we do something with him? Now, Bill Buckley, the man for whom and with whom I founded National Review, in a way, my spiritual son knows of my existence. He cannot possibly say he's overlooked my existence. And yet, the agency of which he is a member, and to which he gives the blessing of the conservatives, has overlooked my existence. Now, you forgive me, I hope, this detour into vanity, into personal complaints, but I beg you to see that I did not complain. I have enough to work on, and I have enough to do, and I'm doing well enough as it is. I certainly don't look for this additional work or this additional worries and difficulties I might have if I am engaged in anything that is even slightly connected with the U.S. government. I only say it happens that I am happy to be an American citizen, that I am glad to be an American citizen, that I am most anxious and most willing to help, that I am fighting a battle in Europe for the United States, the like of which you could not possibly present. And I want to be of service to the United States. I'm just about the only one in Europe who wants to be in this. But the U.S. government just wouldn't take me. Now, so it was not vanity, but a rather important observation. And that is, foreign policy, I say, is the press. The U.S. government is losing the Third World War, i.e. the International Civil War, because it has first not understood that there is no national foreign policy, but the policy of one side of an international civil war that has to be fought openly, in a partisan way, unobjectively, that has been fought so that it is believably a foreign policy that intends to win. Secondly, the U.S. government and the United States are losing this Third World War because they do not want to understand that a decisive event has taken place in Europe that's been made possible only because the U.S. government, i.e., unfortunately, Henry Kissinger, is approving of Germany's Eastern policy. You will never be able to lose the responsibility for that. You will carry it. You will be responsible for the sellout of Germany to the Soviet Union that has been taking place already and can perhaps be repaired within a few months, certainly not beyond these few months. And unless the U.S. government, the United States, that means, of course, fundamentally you, realize that this is the case, that the war is being lost in Europe with the help of the U.S. government, it's all over. Now, I hate to cross the ocean merely to give a defeatist speech, but I'm afraid I can't give any other. It's not defeatism, it is realism. I enjoy life in Europe enormously. I thank God every day that I'm still alive and that I have the privilege of being alive. And as I said before, I like the European cuisine enormously and enjoy it and have it. And that I say to you, that all this is gone. And all this is being lost with the cheerful smile of the U.S. government. A cheerful smile of keep cool. Nothing really happens. All this is just ludicrous. And I'm for it anyway, and I'm for detente, and I support Willy Brandt, who is gracefully cooperating with my detente policy. And so you sit there in Europe, as I do, boiling every day anew. You can't conceive it. So when I was invited to come over and to address your gathering, I said to myself, well, I am going to be defeatist because I don't want to lie to you. I'm not going to give you a speech that shows you that conservatism is on the up and up, you practically, as I heard this morning, one intellectually and morally, only have to win a tiny little bit of political power, otherwise you are okay. That the Rubicon has not been crossed yet, but there's a danger that Mr. Nixon, so well advised by Mr. Kissinger, might really go to China and lose his shirt. It's a possibility, it's a danger. And you don't notice, don't want to notice, it's all over. Unless you move at the very last minute. And it is the very last minute. In other words, unless the German government is indeed overthrown before the treaties are ratified in the German parliament, unless this is the case, the Americans will indeed go home, must go home. They have no business to be in Europe after this for another day. And if you think you can resist Mr. Mansfield in his demand to withdraw the last American company in Europe after the treaties are ratified, you are just plain unrealistic. No American, the American people as such, will not understand the American boys are still being kept in Europe after Germany has closed finally and ultimately a treaty of friendship and alliance with the Soviet Union. This is ridiculous. It's inconceivable. Can't be done, and it will not be done. In that sense, it's all over within the next few months. So I said, yes, I'll be delighted to fly over and to see my old friends in New York and to tell him it's very likely too late. But let's try. Perhaps not yet altogether too late. Perhaps we can still do something. And perhaps, I was particularly pleased to hear, if the chief of the U.S. Information Agency is going to be present at this gathering, one can perhaps arouse his curiosity and his interest in the professionally interesting situation which he finds in Europe and which he, excuse me, sir, hasn't made use of yet at all. So that's what I was going to tell you. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
I was going to adjourn the meeting. We will meet in half an hour, not quite half an hour, again downstairs. I do want to add one comforting word after this, and it is simply that in the past, or historically speaking, history has never been correctly predicted. And I now would like to give the floor for a moment to Mr. Shakespeare, who certainly has a right to say something.
Well, to think that I almost missed this luncheon. Professor Schramm, needless to say, I was delighted to be here to hear your very cogent remarks. Let me start out by saying that you have, as of this moment, an invitation to come to Washington. And at least insofar as the USIA is concerned, we will put together all of our people dealing with Europe and with Eastern Europe just to listen to you. When are you going back, by the way?
Next Saturday.
Perhaps we can do it this week and have you come down. I'm not going to comment.
Did you get Mr. Rush here too?
I think he's back in Germany, is he not?
Yes.
Is he here?
Well, I don't notice him in Germany, but maybe he
is. I don't know. I don't know whether I can deliver Mr. Rush. He's probably in Bonn. That's really all that I wanted to say, is that I wanted to be sure that you knew that you had an invitation to come down and talk. But I might make one or two comments, not dealing with the substance of your positions about what you believe to be the tragedy of the United States position on Germany, because that's a matter of policy, although I think our officers should know precisely your views on the matter. Insofar as the influence of the three papers, the Le Monde and the Neue Zürcher Zeitung and the German press, I think that would be particularly enlightening for our people to have that. There's another aspect of it that I think is very important in Western Europe, and you doubtless would agree with it, and that is television. Philosophically, the commentators on television are influenced by the very publications that you're talking about. And so if you're talking about a philosophical fountainhead, I would agree with you that that those two newspapers and the German press generally and one or two others are the philosophical fountainhead which is reflected in television. But it is the day-to-day outpouring of television to the mass of the people which is really the end product which is most damaging to the United States. Now, just to clear up what conceivably could be a misimpression about the United States Information Agency. The agency historically has viewed itself, to use your words, as selling America to the world. I didn't address myself this morning to the substance of what we have tried to do, at least in this administration, in the last few years. We are still charged with the responsibility of presenting America's foreign policy as it is to the people of the world and seeking to gain maximum support for it. That's why we tax the people to have the USIA, and that's what we are charged to do and what we do do and will continue to do. However, there has been a change in emphasis and a change in substance under this administration, and that is we have gone much more to the point of addressing ourselves to the philosophical premises of communism, the thing that Stanton Evans remarked about this morning. I guess you would call it, he thought that we should be more on the attack and less on the sell. Well, without using quite those words, we certainly do need to explain and to seek support for the foreign policy of the United States. But the new dimension that we are trying to move into is also to become a weapon, if you will, in what Professor Schramm refers to, and which I largely agree is really a world civil war, But what that war is all about is whether what is loosely called the communist ideology and what we loosely call the free ideology will prevail. And we are trying to involve ourselves substantively in that matter. And I didn't want that to be lost sight of in what was presented here today. Thank you.
Thank you.